In February, scientists announced a breakthrough in our ability to understand the universe. They had detected the existence of gravitational waves, predicted by Albert Einstein a century ago. What you're hearing in the background is the sound of that detection. Up until now, astronomical discoveries have relied on light. With gravitational waves, it is possible to listen to the activities of things like black holes and other phenomena. This hour on the Joy Cardine Show, we're going to talk to an astrophysicist about the long effort by scientists to find these waves and how listening for them could shape our understanding of the universe in the years to come. My guest is Jana Levin, a professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College of Columbia University. She is also the director of sciences at Pioneer Works, a center for arts and sciences in Brooklyn, and the author of several books. Her most recent, and the one we'll be talking about today, is Black Holes and Other Songs from Outer Space. Jana Levin, welcome to the Joy Cardine program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you taking time to talk with us. So in February, we heard from scientists at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, otherwise known as LIGO, that they had detected evidence of gravitational waves, warps in space-time caused, in this case, by the energy, the extreme energy, of two black holes merging. I mean, it's really hard to get your arms around that. Walk us through exactly what this means. It's a bit much to chew right at the beginning of the show, but unless we have an understanding of this, we really can't go further. Yeah.
What happens with the black holes is one particular source of the gravitational waves is they're like mallets on a drum. The black holes are orbiting each other. They've probably lived together for billions of years. We're very far apart and have been orbiting each other, much like we orbit the sun. And what happens is they cause ripples in the shape of space-time. They literally move around, and the curves of space-time move and adjust and try to follow them. But since nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, even these shifts in the shape of space-time travel outward at the speed of light. So they've been coming towards us for a very long time. But it's not until the black holes get very, very close together in the final stages of their collision. They're may be a couple of hundred kilometers apart from each other. They're orbiting each other near the speed of light. They're about to collide. That the energy in the gravitational waves is so tremendous, it's the most energetic event we've ever detected since the Big Bang, that the gravitational waves get loud enough that they're emitted and we have a hope of detecting them on Earth. Now, it took 1.3 billion years for that loud signal to make it to us. So if you think about it, when those black holes collided somewhere else in the universe, emitting all of this energy and gravitational waves, there were just multi-celled organisms fossilizing on the Earth. We weren't even here. And we've been in this race to detect things like this since Einstein first started to talk about the gravitational waves 100 years ago.
And I mean, he was talking about it from basically it was a theory, a mathematical construct, and it took us 100 years to get here. It's been quite a journey. You describe it in your book, Black Hole Blues. And it reads like almost, for a science nerd like myself, and I'll admit right up front that that would be me, this reads like an adventure story. I mean,
no, that's great to hear, because that's how I intended it.
Well, you succeeded. As somebody who's worked in sound and in audio for his pretty much entire life, for me, this wasn't, when I read this, there wasn't as big a leap for me, because I've always understood that sound is basically a vibration through the air or some other media. It can be water. It could be a tuning fork. Vibrations happen and they act on the world around them. But this was a really tough sell in the scientific community, and you describe it in your book. Why was this so hard to get people to accept?
Well, you know, when Einstein first started talking about it in 1916, he considered it the most important problem to turn to after he finalized his most important theory, the general theory of relativity, which is the theory of curved space-time. He immediately turns to the idea of gravitational waves. But he's not even sure they're real. He goes back and forth for many, many years on whether or not these are real things, whether it can really transport energy, gravitational waves. And so it's a very hard problem. problem. I mean, if Einstein's grappling with it, he wrote papers that said gravitational waves do exist, they don't exist, they do exist. The community argued about it literally for decades. So theoretically, it was very difficult. But when Einstein was working, he also didn't believe in the existence of black holes. He knew about this solution to his theory that described a black hole, but he didn't think nature would allow them to form. So he didn't think there would be concentrations of mass and energy strong enough to create gravitational waves that would ever be detectable. This just wasn't something he considered viable. So if you realize what we went through in the many decades following Einstein, not just to confirm that gravitational waves were in fact real, and we've already indirectly have evidence for gravitational waves from previous experiments and Nobel Prizes in 1993 given to something called the Hulse-Taylor pulsar, which shows that it has evidence of gravitational waves, but never a direct recording. And that's why this is so exciting. In the decades following, black holes started to understand they were real astrophysical phenomena. We started to have evidence of black holes. And so the energy mounted over the following 100 years. It's also just an incredibly difficult experiment. I mean, incredibly difficult experiment. And so a lot of people didn't really believe LIGO would ever succeed. Even 2 years ago, a year ago, if you had asked people, will LIGO succeed, there would have been people who shrugged their shoulders and said, I'm not sure.
Well, and it was a long road to get to LIGO, and there was a lot of doubt that it would ever get, that the system would ever get built. But before we get to that, we have an email from William. We need to give, and I'm sure he's not the only one, William emails, you lost me at space-time. Can you provide an analogy?
Sure. So if you think again about the mallets on the drum, suppose you were in a vacuum, so the drum was not making what we're used to as sound, which is vibrations of air, but you were running mallets on that drum, the drum would wave. It would literally have waves in the shape of the drum. We, in this analogy, think of space-time as the drum. It's a three-dimensional drum, so it's a little bit harder to visualize, but it's like a drum, and the black holes are like mallets on that drum, ringing literally the shape of space-time. If you were floating nearby those black holes in empty space, you would see nothing. It would be darkness because the black holes emit no light, but you would be squeezed and stretched by these changes in the shape of space and time. And that squeezing and stretching could also pluck your eardrum, we conjecture, although it's not an experiment we can try. And you would literally hear the wave of the drum, even though you were in the vacuum of empty space where you think there's no sound. So it's a lot like almost LIGO, in some sense, is almost like a musical instrument, like an electric guitar that records the shape of the ringing drum. But the experimenters actually listen to the instrument in the control room, plugged in through conventional speakers.
And why is time part of this concept? I think that's what trips a lot of people up.
Yeah, so this is very deep in relativity, this beautiful idea that space and time can be in some sense rotated into each other, so they're not separate concepts. So let's say I say I have a left and a right. You're not surprised if my left and your left don't line up, if my left is somehow rotated relative to your left. And we don't think that the relativity of leftness is surprising, right? But what Einstein did, which was a much bigger leap, is he said not only are spatial directions, you know, sort of relative, we kind of arbitrarily assign left to a spatial direction, even time is relative, that two observers in the universe can see space and time rotated into each other. So what I'm calling space, you might be calling partly time. And this is a very subtle issue that that he proved in 1905 that has to do with relative motions, or later in 1915 with the general theory, also where you are relative to things like the Earth or black holes or the sun. That can change. That can rotate your sense of space and time relative to another's.
You were...
So we can no longer say space and time are somehow separate things. And I think that's true also with forward and backward, or left and right, that these are kind of arbitrary designations. And so we have to acknowledge that one can be changed into the other.
You were working on your book, Black Hole Blues, well before the most recent announcements about the success of the LIGO. What got you started on this project?
Well, I'm a theoretical physicist, which means I like to work on pen and paper and to think about things that can be proven mathematically. And I have been working on black hole collisions and gravitational waves theoretically for quite some time. It's been kind of one of my main threads of research. And so I've always been excited about LIGO. LIGO was very motivating for those of us who were thinking about theories because we thought, hey, there's going to be an experiment in our lifetimes it's going to probe new depths of space and time, and we better be ready for that. We better understand what the range of possibilities might be out there. And so I thought I was going to write a book about black holes and just use LIGO kind of as a motivation. But I got completely seduced by the whole LIGO story. And I tried to not get involved, right? I wanted to be the distant scientist, but I got very involved. I would have to say I became completely enamored of the physicality of the experiment and almost the insanity of the ambition.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the instrument itself. I mean, LIGO, what is it exactly and why is it so big?
So LIGO is currently composed of two instruments on different coasts. One is in Washington State and one is in Louisiana State. And they are what we call interferometers. There are these very large machines that span 4 kilometers each. And what LIGO does is at the ends of those 4 kilometers, in an L-shaped configuration along the two arms of the L, LIGO suspends mirrors, and it simply measures the distance between the mirrors. It sounds simple. The mirrors are suspended very, very delicately so that if a gravitational wave passes, they will effectively bob on the wave, just like buoys in the ocean will bob. And LIGO will send laser light down these arms and compare the light when it recombines back at the corner of the L to see if the two arms bobbed, if the mirrors were 4 kilometers away or a little bit further or closer than 4 kilometers. Now, what's remarkable is the change in spatial distances that LIGO is measuring are less than 1/10,000th of the width of a proton over those 4 kilometers. It's just an incredibly difficult measurement. And so it's very easy to have a hard time finding gravitational waves loud enough to come above just the noise of the machine itself.
It took
50 years to build.
Yeah.
That's not an exaggeration.
No, and a lot of drama along the way, a lot of high stakes, gambling, and it's an exciting story. There were winners, there were losers, a lot of interesting personalities. I want to get to all of that. Of course, we won't. But I want to. So we'll take a short break when we come back. Jan Levin is with us talking about Black Hole Blues and other songs from outer space. And we'll take your questions and comments as well at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or on Facebook, look for the Joy Cardine Show and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network. That's the sound of two black holes colliding. We're talking about Black Hole Blues and other songs from outer space, a new book by Jan Levin. Jan Levin is professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College of Columbia University and is also director of sciences at Pioneer Works, a center for arts and sciences in Brooklyn. She's the author of several other books, including the one we're talking about this morning on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. 800-642-1234. Let's take a call. We'll start in Janesville, and Kenneth is with us. Kenneth, welcome to the Joy Cardine Show.
Hello. Aren't we talking about what's going on physically at the instrument rather than what's going on physically in the black hole?
Kenneth, thanks for the call. Jan 11?
An interesting question. So let's say we were talking about telescopes taking pictures of the sky, like the Hubble telescope. You can make the same argument. Aren't we talking about what's happening at the instrument? Because it's not until light, let's say from a distant galaxy that we see in these spectacular Hubble photos, reaches the satellite, the telescope, that we say, oh, we've taken a picture of that galaxy. So we are saying we took the picture today, but it might have come from the galaxy very far in the past, billions of years ago. And so it's similar here. We're taking a recording, and we're waiting for the sound to get to us from 1.3 billion years ago. But when it gets here, because we understand so much about the prediction of what it should sound like, we can reconstruct the motion of the mallets on the drum. In this case, it happened to be the orbit of two black holes in the final stage before the collision. It was 200 milliseconds right before the black holes collided, formed a new black hole. And you can actually see, I mean, I guess I should use the metaphor here, the ringing down of that final black hole to a perfect, quiet black hole. And all of this is in the recording. So it's always true that even if I'm listening to your question, that what I'm really doing has something to do with what's hitting my ear, but I believe from what I can reconstruct that it actually originated with you.
Well, and the original sound of Kenneth's voice into his telephone is already in the past by the time it gets to us.
Exactly. In this case, it was 1.3 billion years in the past. But exactly. Nothing that we observe is ever instantaneous. It's always lagging behind the speed of light travel time.
Well, and I believe you alluded to this earlier, but one of the problems here is that any vibration will attenuate as it gets farther and farther from the source. We know that is true for sound. It would be, I'm assuming, and maybe that's a dangerous thing, that it would. It's also true for any other kind of vibration. And
absolutely.
So at these distances, what's left of the energy in that wave is got to be just infinitesimal.
That's right. If we think of a loud sound spreading out in all directions, it does get quieter by the time it gets to you. In a strange way, though, the gravitational waves are pretty uninterrupted on their path. There's not a lot that can bother the gravitational wave on its trip over, and that's because gravity is extremely weak. And this is why we need enormous concentrations, not just black holes, but exploding stars or colliding neutron stars, which are a dead star that didn't quite make it to become a black hole. I'm making gravitational waves if I wave my arm around, but it's just, you know, pathetically weak. And so we really don't detect them, or we don't even have any ambition to detect them, unless it's coming from the most cataclysmic astrophysical events.
Let's get back to LIGO for just a moment. Why did it take 50 years to get this thing built?
Well, it's just the technological challenge, really. So when Ray Weiss, who was one of the original architects of LIGO, first kind of dreamt up this idea, oh, I could have mirrors floating, and I could measure the distance between the mirrors, and I could see if space-time was changing. And he thought this up in the late 60s, and he built a prototype. The prototype was only about 1.5 meters long in each direction of the L. And he built it in this sort of shoddy structure left over from the war efforts. And it was just his own private experiment. But he realized very quickly when he thought about any of the possibilities to ring an instrument like that the instrument would have to be bigger, much, much bigger. And he comes to the conclusion it has to be 3,000 times bigger, effectively. And now we have these 4-kilometer-long machines. So it took decades for people like Kip Thorne and Ron Drever to become involved and Ray to continue his program and for them to unite their ambitions and to build an instrument that was big enough to have any hope at all of detecting the gravitational waves.
And uniting their ambitions was a major hurdle. I mean, that took a great deal of work to accomplish.
Yes. I mean, we think of science as objective. At least I do. As a physicist, I really rely on this idea that it doesn't matter who it is who makes a discovery. If it wasn't Einstein, eventually we would have discovered the theory of relativity. And yet, it does matter in the reality of our world, when things happen and if they happen, who's involved and whether they push it through. And in that sense, this is really just a tremendous accomplishment not only for these individuals, but the other 800, nearly 1,000 scientists that are now involved with LIGO. It took, as Ray says, a village to pull this off.
Well, most of your book is focused on the people behind the discovery and the development of LIGO. Why go that route?
Well, it's interesting. I really felt that what had happened when I started hanging around the sites and talking to the experimentalists is that I became very enamored of the process and just the idea that this really is a climbing Mount Everest story. I think we often, with science books, have a sort of idea that the great knowledgeable person comes down from the mountain with the theories and explains them, and that's beautiful as well. But there is sort of a washing over of how hard the climb was to get up that mountain in the first place. And I just felt that that's an important part of what it means to be a scientist. See, when these people struck out to try to make this detection, they didn't know if they would succeed. And there were lots of reasons to worry, and there was a lot of risk involved in taking this ambition on in the first place. And so that is really how science is done. People take risks, and not everyone succeeds, and yet there's this compulsion to keep going forward. And then we have occasionally those who make it to the summit, but we know that not everybody does make it to the summit. And I just felt that it was important to tell that side of the story as well. They're not separate. We separate them in our minds, but they're actually not separate.
Did the scientists themselves ever end up threatening the success of the science?
Sure. Sometimes we're all our own worst enemies. There's always competition, and competition can be healthy, but it can also be destructive. In a project like this, which integrated costs nearly $1 billion and now such a large team, you have to work together. And not everybody on the team could work together so well. So there are stories in the book about just our own human foibles. And I really struggled, I have to say. I didn't want to actually write that part of the story. These are my friends, and I know a lot of these scientists. And it was hard to turn away from this idea that we all are sort of tragic heroes, meaning we all have something that makes us great or is our contribution to the world, but it's often the same thing that is our downfall. And I think that that's a universal theme, not just for science, but anybody can relate to who's trying to do anything. That, you know, sometimes we are our own worst enemies. And I think you see that in this story.
Well, and you share some stories about some failures that took place that were very public that actually set back the progress of studying these gravitational waves. And I guess I was alluding to that as a little bit with the question as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were definitely setbacks. People were fired. People lost their jobs. There were major conflicts. But there was also a real resistance from the community. So at the time that LIGO started to gain some momentum and first acquired a name, so now we're talking about the mid-80s and trying to, there were prototypes, but not the full-scale, large-scale instruments. A lot of the scientific community was against this, totally, totally against this. They didn't think it would succeed. They thought it was taking too much money out of the pockets out of other scientific experiments. And there was also a kind of shadow cast over the field because of previous false claims of a recording by somebody who I now think will be more and more credited as a pioneer, or in some sense always has been, which is Joe Weber. So even before LIGO, Joe Weber was this very industrious, original scientist who thought he had detected gravitational waves in the 60s. He became incredibly famous, one of the most famous scientists of the time. For 2 years, all over the world, people tried to reproduce his experiments, and suddenly the skies were quiet for them, whereas for Joe, his detector was ringing all the time. And it turned very bitter and very bad, and Joe spent 30 years trying to defend his results. But so that cast a kind of dark shadow over the whole campaign. And so there were definitely internal battles to keep pushing forward.
We have some callers who want to join us on this program. Let's take one of them right now. We'll go to Holman, and Bruce is there. Bruce, welcome to the Joy Cardine Show.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm an amateur astronomer, and as such, I'm very, very interested in all scientific discovery of this sort, the gravitational waves, the Higgs boson, the flyby missions of Mercury and Pluto. But what I'm concerned about is how the general public is educated to appreciate the importance of these discoveries. After all, they are basically pure research. They do take a lot of time. They do take a lot of funding and resources. And I'd like to know how your guest and her fellow researchers approach that indifferent or perhaps even negative attitude that the general public might have. You know, they may view this sort of thing as a meh, well, you know, how does this affect the price of gas? There don't seem to be immediate applications, you know, for hoverboards or, you know, whatever. And as I say, it's pure research, but it's so important. You know, how do you, I don't want to say sell your programs to the public, but in your field, how is that approached? How is that dealt with?
No, it's an important question. Often I do get asked, what is this, how is this going to benefit humanity? I don't understand how this is going to benefit humanity. And for a scientist, it's a really funny question. Now, I could give a disingenuous answer that explained how all of this technological fall-off eventually makes it into your iPhone, and that's true, and creates the Internet, and eventually it will benefit humanity in some creature comfort way. But that's absolutely, as you said, not why we do it as scientists. And I think you really sense that in these characters, that they're driven by something much deeper and bigger. And I think that it's kind of like asking, well, what benefit to humanity is it to realize that we're not at the center of the solar system? I mean, it changes everything, right? It changes our entire worldview, and then the consequences to our society and our vision of ourselves in the world are completely different after discoveries that reorient us in the universe. I was interviewed for Al Jazeera TV on the day that the announcement was made. We were sort of sandwiched between reports of violence and war, and we all paused. You know, sandwiched between this, everyone around the world, I mean, maybe not everyone, but lots of people around the world internationally, it's an international experiment, is important to emphasize, stopped to take a breath to look up at the sky and wonder about something that unifies all of us. And I think that's a very important aspect of science. It's true for all of us.
Bruce, thanks for that question. How are we sure that what we heard through LIGO, how can we be sure that this was in fact gravitational waves?
That's an important question. So on the day that the gravitational wave, if you think about it, taking this long journey, it strikes the Earth, it hits Louisiana first and rings that detector, then it travels at the speed of light, even though it's not light, and rings the second detector in Washington. And those two detectors operate completely independently. And so on the day that it struck, there was a note made that there was a loud signal. Maybe it was a candidate for something real, the first detection. But people are incredulous. They can't believe it. They didn't even intend to be running yet. They were still doing tests on the machine. They weren't ready for this to hit. But it was so loud and so perfect that it became an object of intense study. They spent 3 months hammering at it to make sure that it met the criteria that they required for a real detection. And so this is part of what happened with one of your callers mentioned the Higgs boson, which was discovered at the Large Hadron Collider. It's the same phenomenon that they take months studying the data until they're absolutely sure it's not a false signal.
Mm-hmm.
They have very strict criteria for how loud it is and how small the errors are, and it was kind of slow before people started to say, "Wow, I think this is the real thing." They were even worried about false signals intentionally injected into the data, which is something that they do on purpose to test the whole collaboration's preparedness. And so a lot of people thought, oh, this is just one of those false blind injections. This is just something we did to ourselves on purpose. And it slowly became clear that nobody had done that, and that this was, in fact, coming from the sky.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We have Jan Levin with us today on the Joy Cardine Show, professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College at Columbia University. She's also the director of sciences at Pioneer Works, a center for arts and sciences in Brooklyn, and the author of a number of books, including her most recent Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space. You know what? Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have some more callers to join us and more questions for you, Jan Levin. And this is a fascinating topic. And, well, Christy Taylor knows that I would gladly talk about it for several hours. But we only have until 9 o'clock. So we'll do what we can. 800-642-1234. The Joy Cardine Show continues in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy this week. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a science hour on the Joy Cardine Show. John Munson in for Joy. We're talking about the sound that gravitational waves produce when you detect them. Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space is a new book by Jan Levin. Jana is with us to talk about this tremendous breakthrough in science and a really a different way of looking at our universe. We have throughout human history, Jan Levin, looked at our universe. Now we're starting to listen. What is the significance of this shift? What do we gain by listening as opposed to just looking?
Well, I can answer part of that, but part of that nobody knows the answer to. So if we imagine the first time Galileo points a telescope just in the solar neighborhood, he just wants to look at Saturn, he wants to look at the moon and the sun. He has not foreseen galaxies, collections of hundreds of billions of stars, millions of light years away. He hasn't even foreseen a world beyond our solar system. So who knows how huge and vast the universe will prove to be beyond luminous things, dark things that don't hit our telescopes. And so there is this, I think, secret excitement that the scientists have but don't always voice, that there will be something completely unknown that we will discover just by listening that we couldn't discover any other way. Now, having said that, to build an experiment like this, you also have to have some certainties. And we do know that there are black holes, and we do know that there are neutron stars, and we know that there are supernova explosions of dying stars. And all of these are candidates for gravitational waves, so that we know at the very least we'll be able to detect some population of known things. But the black hole discovery, it was very exciting that it was first, because we've never been able to detect two black holes, because they are dark. The only way we ever detect black holes is if they're cannibalizing a neighboring star, or if they're tearing down debris and material. But if you have two black holes by themselves, just the two of them, there is no debris or material. They're completely dark systems. They're just pure space-time coalescence. And so so this was already a real discovery of something we had never detected before.
800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones. And John is with us today from Boaz. John, you're on the Joy Cardine program.
Good morning. It's a very interesting topic, and space-time and challenge, and you made a discovery. Well, it's coincidental to me that the Earth formed about 1.3 billion years ago, and at the same time, the black holes were, the twin black holes, is that?
Mm-hmm.
Were making these waves, mm-hmm. and nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, which is 186,000 feet per second. Well, if you do the math, 1.3 to the ninth times 93 to the sixth, that's 121 to the 15th miles away. Isn't that coincidental to you?
Yeah, so let me just say a few things. I can never quote the speed of light in feet. I'm sorry, I can only quote it in meters or kilometers. But it's about 300,000 kilometers per second is the speed of light. It's quite fast, you're right. And it's traveled for a long time, and it's a big distance in human units. But I should emphasize that the Earth, I think, formed much longer ago than 1.3 billion years ago. So it's more like 4 or 5 billion years ago that the Earth formed. So I don't think there's any great numerical coincidence. And also I should emphasize, this was just the first pair that happened to strike after LIGO had been built. It's like I imagine it as a kind of race across the universe. LIGO's being built, and this first signal is in this race to hit the Earth, and we just want this instrument, and it happens to be up. Literally within the hour of it striking, the experimentalists put their tools down and went home and left the instrument undisturbed in observing mode. That's remarkable. But if we had missed it, there would have been another pair somewhere in the universe. And so we're hoping to start the machine up again soon, maybe over the summer. Right now it's down to tweak it some more and get it into even better shape. And presumably, there will be some other black hole pair somewhere else in the universe at some random distance that has sent gravitational waves our way that will strike in the summer, and we'll pick those up. So it just happened to be the first. I don't think there's any special numerology there.
John, thanks for your question. Let's go to Lydia in Comstock next. Lydia, welcome to the Joy Cardine Show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is very exciting science to me. I'm, you know, a parent with kids, and I try to keep them interested in what's happening in our world today. What strikes me about this is the beauty of the experiment. I might be off topic here. I thought there was an experiment that fired lasers, and they checked the synchronization of the two lasers that they fired, and when they were out of sync, that's how they detected the gravitational waves.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a different experiment, or
no? That's the same experiment. So, what the mirrors are really the important object that you're tracking to see if the mirrors are where you thought they were, or if they've been bobbing on the wave. But to find the mirrors, they shoot a laser from the apex of the L, if you can visualize it, down each arm of the L. The laser bounces off the mirror and recombines at the apex, and then they look at the laser light. If the laser traveled the same distance down both arms, it will recombine perfectly in one port and actually cancel perfectly in what we call a dark port. But if the arms have bobbed, if the mirror has moved slightly away or slightly closer in either direction or both directions, there will become an interference pattern that you can see back at the detector. And that is what they measure. Now, the reason they do that is because we don't have precise enough clocks just to say how long did it take the light to travel down one arm alone and use that to measure the distance of the arm. They don't have precise enough clocks to do it. So this interference of the laser light is a more sophisticated way to measure distances more precisely.
Thanks, Lydia. Thanks for that question. Let's take another from Greg in Waukesha. Greg, thanks for joining us on the Joy Cardine program today.
Oh, thank you very much. I have just two general questions about gravity waves. One is, do we understand where it originated from? Like, do we know the point in space where this wave actually was derived? And secondly, if it's not just one point, do they ever counter each other or cancel each other out? Thank you.
Yeah, so that's a subtle question. If you imagine, again, the ringing drum and the mallets rolling on the drum, the waves on the drum, on the surface of the drum, which are often too subtle to see, but not always, sometimes you can kind of see it wobbling, are kind of big, right? So they're not tiny. They don't originate from a single point. They're big. And that's how the gravitational waves are. The wavelengths is long of this ripple in the shape of space-time, comparatively. And so in some sense, it's due to these gross bulk motions of the mallets, in this case, the black holes. But it can't be pinpointed to a precise single point any more than a plucked electric guitar string or a ringing drum has a wave on it that's localized at a precise point. And that's generally true for gravitational waves. We also think that very large, supermassive black holes millions of times the mass of the sun, collide, and that these will create huge, long, long gravitational waves, and that we'll only be able to detect them from space, where we have built something like LIGO out of spacecraft traveling millions of kilometers apart from each other, as opposed to just 4 kilometers apart.
And is there a plan, a project to do just that, to put to create a LIGO out in space at a much greater distance?
Yes, there is. This experiment's called LISA, and it's under development. LISA is a very important project. We hope that this new excitement will make LISA secure in the funding scheme in the future, and that NASA will join back in. It's primarily a European mission now because the U.S. largely dropped out. So we really want to get the U.S. back into the game for LISA. The idea is to put 3 spacecraft that are not connected. They're small. They're only about a meter and a half or so across. And they contain these mirrors. We put the 3 spacecraft in a kind of triangular configuration in an orbit around the sun. They're millions of kilometers apart from each other. And again, we shine a laser between these 3 disconnected spacecraft, and we try to see if space-time rumbles at a very long, over very large distances, that those spacecraft will slightly bob like buoys on the wave, and that you'll be able to tell that they've changed locations by tracking the laser light in exactly the same kind of way that LIGO does.
So what does LISA stand for, or is that a Simpsons reference?
No, laser interferometer space antenna.
Okay. Everyone was expecting a Star Trek reference. I didn't give it to them.
Probably they start with that, and then they just force the acronym on it.
Okay. Let's take another call. We'll go to Will in Milwaukee next. Will, hello. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, hi, John. I find this to be a particularly fascinating and interesting conversation because my son-in-law is part of the project, and I'm just calling to give a little shout-out to our own local connection, which is UWM here, has been responsible for a good amount of the data analysis, as far as I can understand. So I just didn't want to let you get off the air without giving a pitch for our local connection.
That's great. I'm glad you did that. There are a lot of people. So I wrote this book about the 3 original architects, and it did pain me because there are 800 or more people on this experiment. You'll see at the end of the book I list all of the names in the official author list that were on the Discovery LIGO paper, because you can't do justice to every one of them. But I think it's really important to acknowledge this is an international collaboration, and there are such a large number of names on the Discovery paper, and it's something like 130 different institutions from around the world.
Yeah, I know. I'll look for my son-in-law's name.
Yeah, congratulations to him. It must have been a great day for him.
It was great. He was actually in Washington at the announcement. So.
Oh, wonderful. At the press conference? That was a beautiful day. We were all so excited.
Yeah, we were all at UWM. It was the same day that the Clinton and Sanders debate was going on campus.
So
yeah,
it was a big,
I don't
a big
do
day in Milwaukee.
More recent than a billion years.
Okay. Will, thanks for calling and sharing that information with us. It's not too likely that many people had heard of LIGO before the announcement of the detection in February. And meanwhile, we've got planetary missions like New Horizons to Pluto, the Mars rovers, big public profile. Do you think black holes and their physics can ever be as sexy as the kind of science that takes place a little closer to home?
I think it can be, but it definitely is that you're asking for something else. So the immediacy of what we can do in our solar neighborhood is really exciting. We can get there. We can send physical objects there. We can bring samples back. That's crazy. And we can take these clear, detailed pictures. So that's a wonderful and exciting and immediate aspect of those solar system experiments and projects. With something like this, you are asking people to abstract. And people sometimes have a hard time believing what they can't literally see with their eyes. or can't literally hear with their ears. I mean, it's great that we can turn this into a recording. LIGO, by the way, does span the human auditory range. So these recordings really are in the human auditory range, which is amazing. But I feel that people are up for it. I think that people love this stuff because it reminds us of two things. One, that we're small, and the other, that we're big in a way, that we were able to do this, right? So we're small in the scheme of things, and yet from this sort of puny rocky shore, we've been able to look out into the universe and understand our connection to a cosmos that began 13.8 billion years ago.
So what's the picture of modern science and specifically astrophysics that you want readers to walk away from when they read your book?
I want people to understand that in science, it's not always about the answers, that in fact, you strive for an answer, but really it's about the questions, and it's about the ambition and the endeavor to do something that's never been done before. That's what it is. And at the end of the day, we get an answer, and that's great, and we can brag and share it and, you know, spread it around the world and open our minds and all of this. The ramifications are often beyond anything that we can foresee. But to be a scientist, what you have to be interested in is questions and not knowing the answer and struggling, sometimes in the darkness, and not knowing if you'll succeed. And I think that there's something true about that for all great human endeavors. You can sit down to write a musical score, and you don't know if it's going to be good, and you don't know if you're a great composer, and you don't know if you're going to discover something new in the structure of music. And I think that that's just part of what we are as a species, who we are as a species.
And it's been speculated that there may be a Nobel Prize waiting the scientists behind the LIGO discovery. How likely do you think that is, and how important would that be?
Well, I would just be talking completely casually like anyone else in a cafe about this sort of thing. I have no special insight on the Nobel Committee, but we all feel pretty strongly, those of us, you know, in the scientific community, that it's a very, very, very likely Nobel Prize. And it's not really for me to conjecture who will get it, but I think the three architects that are discussed in the TRICA are very likely candidates, but it's really going to be up to the Nobel Committee what they believe was most important in terms of the success of this experiment.
So now that gravitational waves have been detected, what's the next stop for scientists hoping to learn something from them?
Working very hard on the instrument now. The instrument was actually not completely ready, as I said, so they're trying to get the instrument even more sensitive. And so the experimentalists are going to be working on that for the next 4 months or so. And maybe by the summer we'll hear about a new run, which means they've locked the instrument in observing mode. They're leaving it alone as much as possible to let it do its thing and start to record the skies. And that's going to be an exciting time. We're expecting a lot more discoveries, and then it'll start to operate like a real observatory, which means it's regularly making discoveries about astronomy and astrophysics and what's out there. And you might not hear about it in the news every time because it might not reach to that level, but if we ever hear anything completely unknown, something loud and a source we don't recognize, that'll be pretty exciting.
Well, and I'll be looking for those news stories, and maybe there's another talk show in this someplace, or maybe another book for you. Jan Levin, thank you for sharing this hour with our listeners. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Jan Levin, the author of Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space, published by Knopf. Christy Taylor produced this hour of programming on Wisconsin Public Radio. Elizabeth Deliquist handled our on-air production, and Christy also directed this morning. Thanks a lot to both of them for all of their support for the substitute host on the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow it's On Your Money, and Kevin McKinley is off, but we'll still have some great money advice, so tune in for that. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.